This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Of all the structures he sefer on the basis that Hakoros HaToiv, the acknowledgement of indebtedness, is the foundation of Avodas Hashem, foundation of our service of the Ribbono Shel Olam. For if we don't acknowledge indebtedness, if we don't have that middah of the ability to acknowledge indebtedness, then what really obligates us to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam? And he in fact structures his whole sefer in that order, starting off with analyzing what we owe the Ribbono Shel Olam, and for what we owe the Ribbono Shel Olam. And when he's finished that in the Shaar HaBechino, only then does he start Shaar Avodas HaElokim. He starts the beginning of the Shaar that deals with the service of the Ribbono Shel Olam, because he says a precondition for serving God is feeling an obligation to serve the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that obligation comes from an understanding and appreciation of what we owe the Ribbono Shel Olam. But that concept is a little bit difficult, because it's true, if we look around us, we see the enormous benefits that we derive from the Ribbono Shel Olam, and that inspires us with a sense of gratitude and a desire to respond, a desire to do something for the Ribbono Shel Olam in return for all the goodness that we've received. That lemaisa, we could think a little bit further and we could say, but who asked the Ribbono Shel Olam to put us here in the first place? It's true, now that we're here, is very good to us. But who asked him to put us here? We were in the Shomas, we were spirits quite happy and satisfied up in the Olam HaEmes with the Ribbono Shel Olam, sitting and enjoying his closeness and his goodness. There, good, we would have owed him something. But he comes and he puts us here in this funny world, and he is good to us in this funny world. But we need his goodness because it's a funny world. And he creates nisyonos, he makes things difficult for us sometimes, he causes us to suffer sometimes a little bit. And it's true, he helps us out and he does a lot of wonderful things for us, but still, it's a little bit like saying that I owe an eternal debt of gratitude to an individual who takes me and drops me into the ocean and saves me. Oh, he saves me, he could have left me there. It's true, he could have let me drown, but he didn't have to throw me in the first place. Hadn't he thrown me in, I wouldn't have needed his salvation. So we need to analyze a little bit what the yesod is, what that foundation is. What is it that we're truly grateful to the Ribbono Shel Olam for? It's not just the goodness of this world. Because who needs this world in the first place? This world is not as good as where we came from. And he only needs to give us this chesed because we're in such a world. That's what we're going to deal with this evening, and we're going to deal with it using a principle which we developed this morning in the ladies' shiur, which I'm not embarrassed to repeat. Firstly, because it's important, and secondly, because it's difficult, and thirdly, for those ladies who have already heard it, they'll chazer it, and those that didn't will hear it now. The Medrash says in the Yalkut, on the fourth perek of Melachim Dalet, that there is a contradiction of hanhoga, of method of approach to life, between two of our Nevi'im. Shmuel Hanovi on the one hand, and Elisha Hanovi on the other hand. Shmuel Hanovi adopted an approach in his dealings with people that he would take nothing from anybody. Didn't want to owe anybody any favors. And so, says the Medrash, when the Tanakh says in Shmuel Aleph Perek Vov, Utshuvosoi haramoso kisham besoi, and he returned to Roma for there was his home, Omar Rabbi Yochanan kol mokom sheholof sham, wherever he went. Roma wasn't necessarily where he lived, but wherever he went, besoi imai, he took his home with him, so that he shouldn't have to accept hospitality from anybody. So that he shouldn't have to accept an invitation from anybody. He had his place where he was. He took a caravan with, or he took a tent with, who knows what he did. But he traveled with his home. He never had to accept hospitality. That was the approach of Shmuel Hanovi. And that approach one understands. There's a very important piece in the Hakdoma, in the introduction to the Sefer of Shev Shmaitzer. The Sefer Shev Shmaitzer was written by the Baal Tzvi Sachrishin, and in the introduction, right in the beginning of the introduction, it's a very important piece. He says, discussing the purpose of man's creation. The Ikar Briyas HaOdom Al HaOretz. The main reason for man's creation is this world. That's what is unique about the human being, his ability to operate on this world, as opposed to angels. Even though the neshama was much happier up there, and there was nothing missing in the palace of the king, however, the Ribbono Shel Olam decreed to bring the neshama down to this world, to test the human being in the observance of God's mitzvahs and the keeping of his Torah. And as the human being merits it and grows and develops here in our world, so also it grows, the neshama grows upstairs. Until the person returns to the Ribbono Shel Olam ultimately with much more potency and much more power and strength. Chosuv b'Zohar, it says in the Zohar, "Shesei mayim mevirach v'noizlim miboyrecho v'noizlim mitoich be'erecho." Drink water from your pit and liquid from your spring. And he explains the following: Yeis haneshama lemaylo. When the neshama is upstairs, eino elo bivichinas boir. The neshama is like a boir, like a pit, like a big hole full of water. She'eino noveya. It doesn't spring, it doesn't sprout forth, it doesn't give forth water. It contains. Rak mismalei me'acheri. The neshama is filled from others that it does not fill. Umitzad atzmo hureik. As far as the neshama itself is concerned, it's empty. It doesn't have anything of its own, only what's given to it. Uviyiridoso el ilom hashofel hazeh. And when it comes down to this miserable world, vehisigo mashe oleho lasig, gzeiras chochmos yisborach shemoy, and it achieves what it is meant to achieve in accordance with God's decrees, as he bivchinas be'er, then it becomes like a be'er, like a spring. Hu mayan hamizgaber, that's a spring which gets more and more powerful, the noveya ma'atzmoy, and gives forth water of its own. Uvezeh lo yiyeh na'amad iksufo, and this way when we come back to the Ribbono Shel Olam, we don't get handouts, what we get we've earned. V'yikor demilten, the principle is, dechol delesle migrome klum, anybody who doesn't have from within himself, anybody who is not creative, who is not productive, who is not contributive, a boy rather than a mayan, is a pit rather than a spring. A non-contributive person, only he's like a poor person, choshub kemes. And that's why we consider a poor person like a dead person. Terrible thing, Chazal say. A poor person is considered like a dead person. Why? Because he doesn't have potency. He can't do chesed, he can't give tzedakah. He can't act in the world, he can't be active in the world, and therefore he's spiritually alive. But the purpose of being alive is not to be spiritually alive. We were spiritually alive before we were born too. The purpose of life in this world is to be physically alive. And a poor man is lacking something of his physical life. And therefore, choshuv kemes. And that's why he says, the Maharal says, that mei be'er is kruyim mayim chayim, water from a pit, from a spring is called mayim chayim, living waters. Lefi shehu noveya me'atzmoy, because it's productive, it springs from within itself, it gives forth water. Ma she'en kein mei be'er, which is not the case with the water, mei be'er, which is not the case with water from a pit. That just stands still and it it collects water, but it doesn't give forth. And what is the opposite of an oni choshuv kemes? This is the Maharal speaking. What is the opposite of a poor person who is considered dead? Soine matonus, Mishli says, yichye. One who despises handouts is alive. That's the difference. An oni needs handouts. He lives on handouts. That's why he's like a bow, like a pit. There's no chayus, there's no maim chayim. He's not a living being. He's got to be kept alive. He's got to be sustained by others. But a soine matonus, one who is wealthy enough just to say, I don't need any handouts, thank you very much. That's the only degree of wealth one needs. Then it's yichye. Then one's alive. V'im kein kol zman heyos hanefesh b'mekoiro v'hi b'chinas boir en lo chayos. And therefore, for so long as the neshoma is up in its at its sources, it's a pit and it isn't alive. En lo chayos. It's not, doesn't have that kind of life of chayos. We'll come back to this piece of the Shev Shmaitzer in his Achtoma at the end of the shir. But meanwhile, it's that concept which poses. It's that concept which is the basis of Shmuel Hanovi's Hanhoga. That's why when Shmuel Hanovi used to travel, he used to take his home with him. He despised handouts. He didn't want to feel in any way obligated to another human being. Was it? Not so Elisha. Elisha, we're told, used to come past a little town called Shunam, and there was an Isha Chashuva, there was a very important woman, who noticed that he used to come, and she built on a room for him, and he never said, no, thank you, please don't worry. She built on a room, he said, fine, thank you, stayed in the room. Whenever he came, he used to sleep over there, and she used to provide for him, and give him what to eat and to drink, and he used to take it quite willingly. So two different Hanhogas, Shmuel Hanovi, who never took anything, and Elisha, who used to accept hospitality. But Rabbo says in the name of Rabbi Yitzchok that really there's no difference between the two. If you want to follow the approach where you do accept hospitality and gifts from others, Yahaneh ke Elisha, then you should do so, you following the same method that Elisha followed. And anybody who didn't, who doesn't want to, wants to adopt the other attitude, fine, then he follows the line of Shmuel HaRamosi. Both are acceptable methods. If you want to adopt the approach, I don't want anything from anybody, that's okay. You do it like Shmuel, but that means never. You don't ever take anything from anybody. You're totally self-sufficient. Or you can follow the line of Elisha, because Elisha knew how to take. And that needs a little bit of analysis. What does it mean? Haritze lehenois yeneke Elisha. If you want to take from other people, fine, that's all right, but do it like Elisha does. What is unique about Elisha's method? The Gemara in Brochus and Daf Nun Ches. Tanu Rabbonin, we learn in the Braise. Haroye uchlusi Yisrael. If a person sees a multitude of Jewish people in one place, Omer, he says, Boruch Chochom Harozim. Blessed be the master of secrets. Because you see so many people, millions of people, and each one has his own secrets. Each one has his own thoughts and his own feelings and his own prayers and his own ambitions. And the Ribbono Shel Olam relates to every single one individually, to his needs and to his requests and to his desires. She'ein daiton doim ezeleze ve'en patzufeim doim ezeleze, because they don't have the same opinions and they don't have the same appearances. So many people, and everyone's unique, everyone is different. In other words, there's an instruction here to dwell on the uniqueness of people. When you see a lot of people, don't fall into the trap of looking at them as in their lowest common denominator. Don't try and look at them as one mass of people. That's, as we mentioned last night, is a tendency that we have, to try and categorize everybody into one group. We feel more comfortable if we've got a small number of categories to handle. No, you've got to see each one as an individual and to say, Boruch Chochom Harozi. Ben Zoymo Ro Uchlusu Agav Maile Baharabais. Ben Zoma saw a large multitude of people when he was on a high point at the Har HaBayis, at the Beis HaMikdash. Omar Baruch HaChem HaRozim, he said, Baruch HaChem HaRozim. But he carried on and he said something very, very peculiar. Uvoruch, and blessed be he, Shebora Koleilu L'Shamsheni, who created all these people to serve me. Thank you, Ribbono Shel Olam, for creating so many people to serve me. What does that mean? Isn't that the essence of self-centeredness and arrogance? To look at the world from that light, from that point of view, that they are there to serve me. And he goes on to say, "Who are your Emir? Kamo Yegiyas Yogo Odom Harishim Ad Shemotso Paslecha." Just think, he used to say to himself, when Odom HaRishon wanted a piece of bread, what did he have to do? Just open the drawer in the kitchen and find a piece of bread there and cut it? No. Where would it come from? He wanted bread. Chorash, he had to plow the land. V'zoran, he had to plant the land. V'kotzar, he had to harvest. V'omar, he had to bundle. V'dosh, he had to thresh. V'zoro, he had to winnow. V'rir, he had to sort. V'tochan, he had to grind. V'hirkid, v'lash, v'ofo. He had to knead it and mix it and bake it. V'achar kach ocha. Then, months later, he could have his slice of bread. That's how he could eat a slice of bread. Aval, v'ocha, v'ani, and I? I get up in the morning and breakfast is laid out before me. Who made the breakfast for me? My wife? She just put it together. The servants? No, they just came and laid the table and fetched the bread. Who did it? While I was on holiday in Durban 6 months ago, the farmers were already planting on my behalf. This bread which I'm eating now, 6 months before I needed the bread, and I was on holiday, I was sitting on the beach. They were busy working and working and sweating. What they doing? Plowing the land, planting the wheat, harvesting the wheat. Then I came back and I carried on with my work, and I sat in the Beis HaMidrash and I learned and I studied and I worked and I talked to people. What was happening at that time? The farmers were harvesting and they were bundling and they were taking their wheat to the mill. And then, while I'm sitting at home, listening to some music and going to sleep in the evenings, what was happening? The mills were working round the clock, morning till night and night till morning, grinding and grinding. Right up until last night. Last night when I was sleeping, preparing myself to be refreshed for the new day, the baker Nebuch was in his shop. 3 o'clock in the morning he was in his shop, lighting the fires, getting it going. So that when my servant goes to the bakery at 7 o'clock in the morning to buy some fresh bread, it will be ready. So that when I come after davening at 7:30 to sit down to breakfast, there it is on my place. Aren't I a fortunate person, says Ben Zoma, that I've got this opportunity? And when Odom HaRishon wanted to wear some clothing, what did he have to do? Gozas, he had to shear. The libein, he had to bleach. The nofats, he had to beat. The tova, he had to spin. The orag, he had to weave. The acharkach motza beged lilbush. Then he had something to wear. Vani mashkim, and I get up, and I look in my wardrobe, and I see that my suit's getting tatty. And so I go down to the shop, and I buy a suit. When was that suit made? For weeks and months they've been working on it for me. The farmers have been raising the sheep and shearing the sheep and collecting the wool and spinning the wool and taking it to the factories to weave into cloth. And the tailors have been making it for weeks and weeks. They knew that I was going to need a suit one day, and they come and they didn't just make one. They made hundreds that I could choose the one that I like. And there it is. I buy it and pay for it and take it home. Aren't I fortunate, says Ben Zoma, to live in such a society? What is it all about? He goes on, who are your ime? Oreach toiv mahu ime. What does a good guest say? Kamo torchois toroch bal habayis bishvili. Comes. They're having a sheva brochus. There's a chosen there, there's a kalu there. And there are tens of guests. 50 guests there. He's one of them. Looks around, and he sees it's all laid out before him, beautiful. And he says, my goodness, did the Balabos go to such an effort for me? Kama bosor evilafonai, so much meat for me. Kama yayin evilafonai, so much wine for me. Kama gluskois evilafonai, that's such desserts for me. V'chol ma she'torach le'torach ele bishvili, and all this effort is just for me? He's such an arrogant being. What do you think it's just for you? Why do you think it's just for you? You're just a guest here. There's a chosan and kala. It was for them, not for you. No, that's not what an oreach tov thinks. When an oreach tov, when a good visitor looks at it, he looks at it from the point of view, this is all for me. Aval oreach ra, what does a bad visitor say? What did the balabos have to go to extra work for me? Zeh pasach asochalti. What did I eat after all? One piece of bread, one piece of meat, one glass of wine. It doesn't mount up to much. He was cooking in any case, so he cooked a little bit more for me. It's not the end of the world. That's how he sees it. Two ways of looking at the same thing, which is true. They're both true. And they're both false. But there's an approach that needs to be taken. And oreach tov, says Ben Zoimo, is a person who looks at it from the point of view, it's all for me. I explained this morning that the Chazon Ish paskened in his time, and it's a psak which has taken wide acceptance among Bnei Torah and Eretz Yisrael today, that even though there are heterim, now this permission has been given for, at that time certainly, Jews even, to work in the essential services on Shabbos, such as the production of electricity. Because things would come to a standstill. There would be a security problem if there was no electricity. There was problems with pikuach nefesh, hospitals. Nevertheless, he paskened that from Jews, or Jews, should not use the electricity on Shabbos. Not just, of course, to turn it on and off, that's an issur d'oraisa, but should not even use it on a time switch, the way we use electricity. Because the fact is that there are Jews in the power stations providing the electricity which I'm benefiting from. And there were those who opposed that psak and said, no, once those Jews are allowed to be making the electricity, which they are, then I'm just using it. They're not making extra for me. And while this, one can't apply this to halachic reasoning, this piece of Gemara, but it certainly is important in approach. The correct approach is they are doing it for me. The fact that they have other reasons to do it makes no difference. Each individual has to relate to the source of his benefits as if those benefits are designed specifically for him. And if we're going to live that way and operate that way, then when I sit in my house and I come in and it's dark and I turn the light on, I should think to myself, my goodness, just as Ben Zoma said, how many people are working through the round the clock so that I can flick my light on? The miners who go down into the ground to dig out the coal, the owners of the mines who invest risk capital to open mines in which miners can go to fetch the coal, the railways that work through the day, through the night, transporting the coal to the power stations, the people working in the power stations, the people who laid the cables and service the cables and bring it right to my doorstep, and watching it all the time so that nothing should go wrong, because they know if I come and I turn on the light and the electricity doesn't go on, there's going to be a big tumult, everybody's going to be controlling, everybody's going to be complaining. If in the area there's no lights, everybody phones, what's happening, so they've got to keep it going, just that I can come and flick it on. And I've got to feel that. They're all working for me. Just as when I go into somebody's home as a guest, I've got to feel it's all for me, even though it's not all for me, but that's how I must feel. So when I turn on the light, as an oreach tov, as a good citizen, I must feel this is all for me. In that case, I can't use it on Shabbos. If it's all for me, and they're Jews providing it, it goes against the whole principle to benefit from it on Shabbos. On Shabbos, they mustn't be working for me. And that's an attitude with which one has to live, and an attitude which makes life so very, very rich and increases one's sense of gratitude and one's sense of appreciation. All of a sudden one starts noticing things and responding and relating to things which one would otherwise take very for granted. But there's more to it than that. The Midrash said If you want to benefit, do it like Elisha. What did Elisha do? When he'd stayed over at the Shunamis' house, he calls Gehazi, his butler, and he says, Gehazi, we've got to respond somehow. We've had Achnosis Orchim here. What does the Balabosta need? Call her and ask her, what does she need? Would she like us to intervene, to talk to the king on her behalf, to talk to the commander-in-chief of the army, maybe to get some kind of benefit? What can we do? Does she want to use our influence in some way? She's gone to such trouble. And Gehazi comes back and says, the woman answers, I dwell among my people, Baruch Hashem, I've got whatever I need, nothing missing. And Elisha starts getting worried. Elisha starts getting irritated. What do you mean? We've got to find something. There's got to be something she needs. And Gehazi eventually says, the only thing she doesn't have is a child. Good, says Elisha, then we have to see to it that the Ribbono Shel Olam gives her a child. But we can't leave here without giving her anything. The fact that she's got everything doesn't make any difference. We've got to give her something not because she needs it. We've got to give her something because we need to give her something. Why? Because a person is alive only as in as much and insofar as he despises handouts. And if we can walk away from this woman having received a handout, and we can continue to live with ourselves, then we're not alive. That's not life. That's not what we were created for. What did we learn in the Hakdoma of the Chef Schmeitzer? That's the purpose that we've got to be here. Anybody who's not contributive and productive is considered like a mace. And Elisha says that doesn't mean just in the sum total of your life. It's not just at the end of your life you must be able to draw a line like a balance sheet and add up whether you were productive or not. That means in every situation you've got to be productive. In every situation you've got to be contributive. And for us to walk away from a situation where we received and gave nothing, that's not good enough. We've got to find something we can give her. And Gehazi says, just a son, that's all she's missing. The Medrash says, if you want to accept hospitality, then you've got to be able to do it like Elisha. In a way where you're intolerant of being non-contributive. Then you're entitled to receive hospitality. And that Medrash really is explaining the pshat in Ben Zoyma. And Ben Zoyma comes along and he says, Baruch Chochom Harozim, blessed is he who is master of the secrets, Uvoruch Sheboruch Kol Eilat Shedusham Sheni, and blessed is he who created all these people to serve me. What's that arrogance? No. That means I'm receiving handouts. That's what he's saying. These people are related to me. They're not strangers. They're working for me. That one there, he's the baker. That one there, he's the farmer. That one there, he's the miller. That one over there, he had the sheep, the clothes I'm wearing. That one there spun the wool. They all did it for me so that I can wake up in the morning and have my breakfast without having to do a minute's work. So that I can go and buy a suit of clothes. Whereas Odom HaRishon had to work for months before he could do that. These people here have contributed to an economy and to a society which makes me able to benefit constantly. Surely I've got to respond to them. I owe them. I don't want to be the recipient of their handouts. I've got to respond to them. That's why the Gemara goes on to say that's the same Ben Zoyma who says that when a visitor comes in, he's got to look at it as if it's all for him. He must not look at it that all he's having is a piece of bread. No, he's got to look at it that everybody else was invited here in his honor, that all the food was put there in his honor, that everything that is there was done for him. And that creates an enormous sense of indebtedness. All this for me, what am I going to do? Oh, what you're going to do? Like Elisha. Now you start thinking. Now you start figuring out what you're going to do. Because you're in a situation of indebtedness. One can understand this a lot more clearly. I explained to the ladies this morning, when one sees the conflict, the contrasts between Western society and Eastern society, certainly in its more classical form. where in contemporary Western society and Eastern society. Eastern society, I'm talking about the Far East, the Orient. Eastern society understand this principle to an absolute extreme, where there is nothing more demeaning than to be indebted in the East. And one needs to understand that before one goes there, because if one doesn't, one goes for a loop very quickly without even knowing it. And there are a few examples of that. Firstly, there is an intricate process of dancing around one another before business negotiations even commence. There's talking, there's having a cup of tea, there's going out for dinner, going out for lunch first, then there's going out for dinner, other forms of entertainment. And entertainment in a place like Japan, for example, is very expensive. If you take a business colleague out for an evening and you entertain him karaoke, you can be a good few thousand rand poorer at the end of the evening. That's for one business colleague. If you take a party out, which is usually, you can't just take one, you take him and his boss, his colleague, and his the one just under him, you take five or six people out. On South African foreign currency travel allowances, you won't be able to get home after that. What's the idea? The idea is that before negotiations start, you should be indebted. You've had a good evening out. And the more expensive the evening, the better it is. They love to spend money on you. And the more, and on each other, it's the same thing. They love to spend money on a competitor. Because the more money they spend on a competitor, the better the business deal they're going to get. And one needs guidance through the etiquette. It's quite amazing. You're invited out, and when it happens to me, I have to check with my local as to whether we can or can't accept. And if we can't accept, what excuse do we give without it making seem obvious why we're not accepting? And the one who'll say, yes, you can accept because I took him out 2 weeks ago. He owes us the big cashman. Yes, this one we can accept. The next one, no, we can't accept. Can't accept. This one you can accept, he says, because we're not going to be doing business with him. It's okay. We're not going to see them tomorrow, so they'll have nothing on us. The other one, no, this one you can't accept, because tomorrow we're going to be doing business with them, and we want a good price tomorrow. Now you've got to choose. We either go out with them for lunch, and then there's no, never, they don't do very well on our kind of lunches, but and that bothers them. The kosher people, they don't spend much money on us. But if you're going to try and do a deal with them the next day, no indebtedness. Because you can't have them entertain you in the evening and still ask them for a good price the next morning. That you can't do. You've got to choose. You want a good evening, that's fine, but then you pay their price tomorrow. And that's why people don't understand, but that is the whole concept of suicide in the Far East, particularly in Japan. There is no way that they would, in the old days, until relatively recently, have continued living if they had debts they couldn't repay. That was absolutely unacceptable. Can't repay a debt, then suicide. Because pride is more valuable than money, than life. So it is. And the pride of being self-sufficient is so enormous that they won't. And people don't understand that, and people don't understand the culture. But there is such a thing, and we too have such a thing. The concept that if one can't pay one's debts, one sells oneself as an eved. Also such a concept. You can't live as an independent man owing money which you can't hope to repay. You need to sell yourself. So they don't have the selling yourself, that they don't do. Killing themselves they consider a higher form of existence than living as a slave. Life is not quite valued as the way we do. Whereas in the West, it's punkt verkehrt. If you can do business using somebody else's money, so much the better. If you can manage to go bankrupt in such a way that only your creditors lose money but you don't, so much the better. If you can do a good deal in such a way that you've done somebody out of something without him even knowing that you've done so, you're a chochem, you're a good businessman. And the fiction and the movies that are made, the hero is always somebody who comes out having done a good deal, one way or another. And a good deal means that he has benefited at the expense of somebody else. That's the hero with whom the West identifies. Whereas in the East, it's not so. The heroes of their literature and the heroes of their art are always people who in the end pay their debt. It's a long story, it comes to the end. They all end either in suicide or in paying up. That's how it ends. That's the ultimate of human existence. Paying or dying. Whereas with us, the ultimate is in the West, or the Goyim, the ultimate is managing to get away without paying. That's the height of intellectual achievement. Ben Zoima points out that we have to go through our lives constantly mindful of the indebtedness which is being created around and about us. That everything we benefit from creates another level, a new level of indebtedness. We like to think that we've paid for everything. We get into an airplane and we sit down and we ring the button for the stewardess to come and bring us a Coca-Cola, and if she takes 2 minutes to come instead of 1 minute to come, we've got something to say already. What's so long? Why are you? I've rung twice already. Why haven't you been here? I'm paying for this, you know. Figure out what it really costs. Figure out what it costs to manufacture the research that has gone into the last 80 years of flying, and the cost to manufacture an aircraft capable of transporting you at that speed from Johannesburg to Tel Aviv, or wherever you're going. Figure out what it costs, and employing staff, and radio controllers all the way, with all the radio beacons all the way, putting up an airport at both sides, and then tell me you've paid for it. Your little ticket, you've paid. What have you paid? And nothing, a small, it's a gesture, that's all it's a nothing. It's a different way of looking at it. I've paid. You've paid nothing. This has been paid by generations. And you, what did you pay? Your little ticket? That doesn't cover anything. What right have you got to feel resentful if the service isn't quite as you would like it to be? On the contrary, the right approach then of a Ben Tura would be, thank you so much for coming. I know how busy you must be. I know how difficult it must be for you to attend to everybody. How nice of you to have found the time to attend to me too. Can you imagine what a Kiddush Hashem that would be? If that's what the air hostesses would get from the Frum Jews, sitting on the aeroplanes, each time they went to a Frum Jew, that's what they said. Gosh, how can I repay you the indebtedness I feel towards you? Baruch Shebara Kol Eli L'Shamsheni. Look around, all these stewardesses, and the pilot in the cockpit, and the airport staff, and they're all there L'Shamsheni. How am I ever going to repay them? And you go to the pilot afterwards, you say, how can I pay you for bringing me here so quickly and safely? And to the air hostesses for attending to me, and for the porters who carry the baggage, how can I pay you for this? Imagine what an approach that would create in ourselves, and what a response that would elicit in others. The first one who did it, they would think is a meshugana. But when they started seeing more and more people doing this kind of thing, they would also start to think. And imagine how we would feel when people do it to us, in our work situation. So imagine somebody came to you and said, my goodness, instead of looking at your product and saying, wonder if I couldn't have got it a bit cheaper somewhere else. If instead of that, the person would say, my goodness, thank you for serving me. Thank you for helping me. It's such a bargain. I don't know if I could have got it cheaper anywhere else. All I know is that when you think of what's gone into making this article, how could one get it cheaper anywhere else? One looks at a bottle of wine. Sometimes I sit on Shabbos at the table. I look at a bottle of wine. Sometimes the tag is still on it. Whatever, 10 rand, 8 rand, 12 rand, whatever it is. You think, my goodness, this wine? There's a farmer somewhere who bought land, planted vines, waited years for the vines to grow, tended them, plucked the grapes, sold the grapes to the vineyards, to the wine manufacturers, people who made it. Then there's the whole production of the bottle. Now the thing altogether, there's a bottle factory. And the two have to come together. The bottles get filled and the wine gets pasteurized and sealed and there's hashgocha. And then it gets transported from the other end of the world to my table. And what does it cost? 10 rand? 9 rand? 8 rand? 12 rand? For all that? It's pennies. But why does it work? Because we're all involved in an economy. Because I'm not the only one. That's why it works. If I was the only one, that would cost me millions of rand to get that bottle. But because we're all involved in an economy, I can get it for 10 rand. So how am I going to repay everybody that I can have such a nice bottle of wine on my table for 10 rand? or fruit or bread, the same thing, is Renzoin the same? That's an eternal debt of gratitude that we owe to every participating member of the economy and of the society. And if we adopt that attitude, there's such an indebtedness created within us that we need to be constantly doing for others, somehow repaying, somehow helping, somehow doing our bit to make sure that others too can benefit from us in the same way that we've benefited from them. That's what Ben Zoima means. Not to sit there, ha, Baruch Shabaruch Kolele L'Sham Sheni, they're all here to serve me. They're all here to serve me, that means I owe them a debt which I'm almost incapable of paying them. How am I ever going to do it? That's Kol Asher, Kol HaRoitze Le'enos, Yane Ke'elisho. If you want to take Hanor from others, if you want to benefit from others, fine. But you do it Elisho's way. No other way. And that's why when we go to one another for a meal or for whatever, we carry a little gift with us. And even that is so inadequate. And one has to find other ways as well of expressing and understanding that that's inadequate. It doesn't just go and sit down and eat and walk out. It's a lack of derech eretz. It shows a complete inability to understand what an oreach toiv is. Somebody says, look, I can't repay you for this wonderful meal you've given me. But just to show you that I acknowledge gratitude, here's a bunch of flowers, or here's a box of chocolates, or here's a whatever. That's how we do it. But not even to do that shows a complete insensitivity to the process of interpersonal relationships. And the point that I'm making based on this Gemara is that that applies not only where we're going as a guest and we're receiving a free handout, but it applies even where we're paying. Because in our system of economy, what we pay for is such a minute part of what the value really is, that we need to think that way more, rather than keep on thinking, we like to measure value by whether we can get it cheaper. The thing it costs 10 rand and somewhere else I could get it for 9 rand 99, then I'm worried that I've been taken for a ride. That's how we think. That's the Western way of thinking, because the art of Western life is to get away with paying as little as possible and getting as much as possible in return. Working as little as possible for the highest possible wage. That's the whole method of Western thinking. That's the whole method, and that's the method that communism works on. And that's why those who are least productive love it so much, because they promise them more money for doing less. And that's the ultimate. That's not the Torah approach. The Torah approach is it only costs 10 rand. The fact that it costs 9 rand 99 somewhere else doesn't make any difference. We're talking pennies. The fact is it costs 10 rand and it's worth 1,000. That's what's important. What is a loaf of bread worth? What is a glass of water worth? Uncountable fortunes. And it costs pennies. That we need to realize. That we need to appreciate. That's how it's a lehenos yahaneke elisha. You want to take hospitality, you want to take handouts, you want to interact with society, you've got to do it elisha's way. What about our relationship with Ribbono Shel Olam? So much goodness he showers upon us. From morning till night, we live, we're healthy, we have what to eat, we have where to sleep, we have friends, we have a society, we have what we need. Constant, constant chesed. And yet, the Baal Shev Shmaitzer says that the Ribbono Shel Olam put us here to develop out of being a boir, a container, into becoming a ba'er, a spring. Can that be also in our relationship to the Ribbono Shel Olam? The Sedra starts, Ahoyo ekev tishmun es ha-mishpotim o'ele, and it shall be as a consequence of your accepting these mishpotim, ushmartim va'asisim o'isom, and you shall keep and observe them, the Shomar Hashem Elokecha L'Chois HaBris Ve'es HaChesed Asher Nishba La'Avisecha. The Ribbono Shel Olam will keep the covenant and kindness which he has sworn to your fathers. What does that mean? The Ribbono Shel Olam has given us the most unbelievable opportunity. This pasuk needs to be read in contrast to one of the final psukim of the previous sedra. And this is pointed out by the new Medrash Rabbah on Dvorim. Dvorim, we've always known, has not been the true Medrash Rabbah. The Medrash Rabbah on Dvorim is another Medrash. It's not the Medrash Rabbah. And for centuries we haven't had the Medrash Rabbah. It was only relatively recently that Kisvei Yad were found, which are the actual Medrash Rabbah. And there the Medrash points out that at the end of the previous Sedra, Umeshalim L'Soinov El Ponov La'avidoi, that the Ribbono Shel Olam pays those who hate him immediately in order to destroy them. He doesn't delay at all to repay those who hate him. And while there are some that want to learn that, the Rashbam learns that that's talking about paying those who hate him for their wickedness, Rashi doesn't. In his lifetime, immediately the Ribbono Shel Olam rewards him for his good deeds. Whereas with us, Ekev Tishmu, because of doing it, Ekev, ultimately, Hashem is going to keep all the reward and he'll give it to us one day. What kind of business is that? So there are various Medrashim, both in Medrash Rabbah and in the old Medrash Rabbah and in the new Medrash Rabbah, that all point in the same direction. There's one in the newly found Medrash Rabbah brings a story which is very beautiful and explains an awful lot. Maaseh b'Rabbi Zainun sh'yobo l'Alexandria. There was a story of Rabbi Zainun who used to come to Alexandria. V'hoyo sham roifei echot. And there was a doctor there in Alexandria, posoyach pischoi k'neged avodazor. And the entrance to his surgery faced a place of idol worship. And in that town there was one very kosher man who used to do mitzvahs. From man. And he suffered terribly. He was lame in his arms and his legs. Terrible, terrible suffering. But an odom tzaddik, a from man. One day he was dealing with a very great man. This lame person had dealings with a very important person. And this man was standing, this important man, wealthy, well off, he was talking blasphemously about the Ribbono Shel Olam, and he was serving idolatry. So this poor lame man who suffers so terribly looks at this gorgeous being, big, powerful, healthy, wealthy, blaspheming, serving idolatry and thriving on it. The Omad v'nichnas l'beis avodah zara. And he succumbed and he went off also into the beis avodah zara. This lame man went into the house of worship of the idols. Miyad yotzo misham bori mahalich baraglov. And he walked out perfect, healthy, walking on his two feet. One hears these stories and you see from the Medrash we're entitled to believe them. Isn't there a funny stone somewhere or other that one has to lie upside down on or do some funny things on and people are claimed to be healed? Kenzai? No problem. Imagine the doctor now. The doctor has been there for years trying to treat this lame person unsuccessfully and knows that he's a frum yorei shemayim and is still unsuccessful to be able to do anything for him. And he looks out of his surgery window, sees the lame person wheeled in, suffering and all folded up into the Beis Avodah Zarah, and a few minutes later he sees him walk out on his two feet, striding briskly past his surgery. Oh, Yotome, he was amazed. The doctor, locked his surgery and went off to the Beis Hamedrash to find Rabbi Zainan. Amalei said to him, Risi, Odom Echod, Yusur Mekuto, Yodov Raglov, I saw this man in suffering, in pain, lame in his arms and legs. He went into the house of idolatry, served there, and came out healthy. I'll explain to you what this can be compared to. You can have a man who was honest and modest. And everybody used to deposit money with him. They used to trust him to look after their affairs. And when they used to deposit money with him, What's your name? When I come to get my money, I'll know who to ask for. That's all. You don't have to give me receipts, nothing. Just tell me who you are so that when I come, I know who to ask for. Once a man came and gave him a deposit. He said, what is your name? I need to know. He said, my name's Yossi. So the depositor went. After a while he comes back, he forgot the name of the banker. He thought it was Shimon. So he said, Shimon, I've come back to get my money. Now there's almost nothing that insults a person so much as getting his name wrong. So even spelling his name wrong usually gets people angry. Getting their name wrong gets them very, very upset. And there's nothing that makes people so happy as getting their name right. It's a wonderful blessing. Those people who have the talent of remembering people's names over long periods of time, it does wonders for interpersonal relationships. And he realized this fellow's made a mistake. And he knew that he's forgotten his name. So he said to himself, I'm upset, but is that a reason not to give him back his deposit? Certainly not. Not love a tofu upon him. He took his deposit and threw it at him. Omar, he said, oh, tarif lo pikdoin. Here, take it, go. Whereas if somebody comes and says, hello, Yossi, you remember I came out? I say, yeah, sure. And how were things? How's everything? Everything's all right. I have a little schmooze. And eventually give him the money. Not in this case. The person doesn't even remember your name. You give him the money and off with him. This from person too did mitzvahs, and the reward for those mitzvahs were deposited with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And when he denied the Ribbono Shel Olam and went into that house of idolatry, and so to say, forgot the Ribbono Shel Olam's name, Omar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mas Choro Shel Zeh Oseh B'Yodi. What am I still doing with this man's deposit? Miyad Poro La HaKadosh Baruch Hu Schoro. So the Ribbono Shel Olam paid him for everything at once. Were a foe and healed him in one moment. So that he should no longer have a deposit in the hand of the Ribbono Shel Olam together with the tzaddikim. That's why he came out healthy, and that's pshat in the pasuk at the end of Eschonon. Pays them off immediately. This is an amazing concept, and as I said, there are many midrashim along this line. This is an amazing concept. The Ribbono Shel Olam, in his Chochmah, has designed a system where, despite our complete insignificance, and despite his infinite chesed, we can come and stand before him on Yom Hadin. Just imagine for a moment. Imagine that you run into financial difficulties. You have a friend who's got money. You ask him to help you out, which he does. A month later you come back to him, you say, you know, that money you gave me, it's gone, I've lost it. Can you lend me some more, please? That's good, some more. A little bit later, some more, he helps you out, and you can't respond, you can't repay him. One day you have a case, a court case. Somebody takes you to court, and you go into the courtroom. Who's the dayan? Your friend who's been lending you the money. You're standing there, indebted to him. If it were allowed, if such a situation were allowed halachically, imagine what an embarrassment. Okay, you've got to stand before somebody that you owe your life to, and he's got to judge, and you've got to justify yourself. Imagine coming to the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Olam HaEmes, and having to stand before him, where not only is he the judge, but he's the claimant also, being indebted to him in a way where we cannot possibly repay. Can you imagine any worse hell than that? So the Ribbono Shel Olam has designed a system where we can come and stand before him as a creditor, not as a debtor. Do you know what that is? To be able to stand before our dayan, to be able to stand before our judge as creditors. Do you know what a feeling of confidence that can give us? What that can do to our pride, our self-image, our ability to stand before him? That he owes us all the mitzvahs that we've done. He hasn't paid us yet. That we can be creditors to the Ribbono Shel Olam? That's a concept. When I worked this concept this afternoon, I went out of my mind. that we have, that it is possible to have a relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam where we are the creditors. And that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants. And it's only his sonim, only those that hate him. He likes to pay off as quickly as possible, so that when you come before me, you're a debtor, not a creditor. You stand before me as a debtor. You stand before me as somebody who owes me, not somebody I owe. That concept in itself is already amazing and encouraging. But enveloped in it, there's a second concept. How does he do it? So much the Ribbono Shel Olam has done for us. So much chesed. How can we be creditors? He's given us life. He's given us Torah. He's given us health. He's given us everything we've got. Every minute, every second of the day, as the Chovos Halvavos goes through, we're constantly indebted and re-indebted and re-indebted to him. What can we possibly do that can get us into a position of creditor? How can we even equal what he's done for us? Never mind exceed what he's done for us. So there are two ways that could be done. Imagine, one way would be that he puts us into a terrible world where we suffer from the beginning to end, where it's just a life of total suffering. And we really have, we don't owe him anything, because we've suffered from the moment we were born, chas v'shalom. That would be one way that we could come upstairs and say, Ribbono Shel Olam, 1 minute. Look, I don't owe you anything. You put me on that miserable world and I didn't have 1 minute of nachas, not 1 second, but I did a few mitzvahs. Pay up. Good. That way I can understand that there's a relationship of creditor. But he didn't. He puts us in a world which is comfortable, which is pleasurable. He gives us what we need. He gives us company. He gives us family. He gives us food. He gives us whatever we need. And to varying degrees, we all have nachas. All have nachas. We have our problems too. But we all have a great deal of nachas. So how can we become creditors? Imagine if I employ you to do a job of work. I say, look, you come. What I need you to do is just to answer the phone for me this morning because my secretary's off. You say, no, answer the phone for you this morning. That means I can't be at my own place of work. You'll have to compensate me. Oh, I say, of course I'll compensate you. How would $1 million be paid in an overseas bank account for doing that? You say, no, sorry, that I can't accept. It's ridiculous. It's completely out of proportion. What happens? I say, you know, I want to pay you $1 million. I really want to. No, you say, then I've got to do much more for you. Then I've really got to work for it. But imagine something else. If I say to you, there's a phone call coming in for me sometime during the morning. I need a well-spoken person to be able to answer the phone. I won't be there. If a well-spoken person answers the phone and handles the call intelligently, I'm going to make a clean profit of $100 million. I would like you to have one of those million. Then it's not so disproportionate anymore. And I say, look, come and sit down. I'll give you a comfortable office and a chair. There's a shas there next to you. All the sforim you want while you're waiting. You don't have to do anything. Sit and learn. Enjoy yourself. All you have to do is when the phone rings, you answer it nicely. And we're going to make so much out of this that really the million that you're going to get out of it makes it's neither here nor there for me. You'll do well. I'll do well. That's fine. But then you don't feel so embarrassed anymore. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam has done for us. He has created something, a job for us to do, so valuable that the pleasure we have in doing so, the comfortable chair, the big desk, the shas that's standing next to us, the air conditioning, is all so irrelevant because the job is so big and the income from the job is so enormous that we're able to have pleasure and to be owed. Because imagine, after you take the phone call, I come along and say, you know, about that R1 million I offered you, $1 million, I've got a bit of charota. $1 million to answer the phone? Is it really right? What did it cost you after $1 million to answer one phone call? Look, how about I'll take you out to coffee and we'll call it a day. I'll pay for the coffee. What's it after all the phone call? You didn't even pay for the phone call. Then you start getting upset. You say, 1 minute, ah. How much did you make out of that phone call? $100 million. Could you have made that if I didn't answer the phone? No? So I made you $100 million. What's it your business how much it cost me to make it? I made you $100 million. And you're entitled to do that. It's not a question of how hard I worked, it's how big the job was, how important the job was. The Rebbeinu Shalom comes and he says, one little mitzvah. It's not important. Don't you work out whether it's a big mitzvah or a little mitzvah, how much it's worth. That's not important to you. To me, it has infinite value, says the Rebbeinu Shalom. That it outweighs, that one little mitzvah can outweigh all the goodness which you're enjoying, all the kindness I'm pouring on you, all the goodness, all the nachas, all the happiness you have is nothing compared to the nachas I get from you doing one mitzvah. That's how great it is. Then we realize not only the wonderful opportunity we have to become creditors of the Ribbono Shel Olam, but we realize the power and potency, the magnificence and bigness of the Torah, that He's created something so powerful, so enormous, so dynamic, that by us doing our little mitzvahs, it more than pays for everything. It leaves us in the black. It doesn't leave us in the red. It leaves us in the black. As long as we do that, that's all we have to do. We have to answer the phone for Him, daven our tefillahs, learn our Torah, keep our kashrus, keep our shabbosim, our yom tovim, raise our children in Torah mitzvahs, answer the phone, little jobs. But those little jobs are so important to Him. He makes hundreds of millions with every little job we do. And He's prepared to share all that with us. It's our hundreds of millions, it's not His, He doesn't need it. And He keeps it for us. So that when we come on that embarrassing day, and we have to face the Ribbono Shel Olam and look back at our lives, we can come with a certain self-respect. You know the story of the Rav that used to, every Friday afternoon, he used to go to one of his balabatim, just before Shabbos, say, please lend me $100. Oh, right, $100. He would say, thank you, put it in his pocket, and go home. Immediately Shabbos was over, he used to come back with $100. Pay back. Next Friday, he would do the same. Eventually came an Erev Yom Kippur once, the Balabos couldn't contain himself. He came to the Rav, he said, you know, I'm sorry I've got to ask you this, but I can't go into Yom Kippur worrying and doubting. I've got to ask you. Every Shabbos you come right out of Shabbos to borrow $100 and you return it the next, right after Shabbos. What do you do with it during Shabbos? It's very simple, you know. I've got to get up on Shabbos and give a drosha. And I've got to give musar to Balabatim. Some of them are wealthy, some of them middle class, all sorts of people. Much easier to do it if I've got $100 in my pocket at home. Much easier. I can speak with a different sense of pride. Different way. To be able to stand before the Ribbono Shel Olam with a credit balance means we can face Him. We can talk, we can negotiate, we can deal, we can answer, we can ask. The embarrassment is not all-consuming. As difficult as it's going to be to have to explain our lives and answer for our lives, at least we know He's sitting there as a creditor, not as a debtor. The Ribbono Shel Olam is not sitting with His hand out saying, no, pay up now. Now's the time to pay up. You've had your good time. Now you pay up. No. The Ribbono Shel Olam is sitting there and He's saying, Reb Yid, after all, lots of mitzvahs you did, I haven't even paid you yet. I still owe you an awful lot. Thank you for what you did down there. I know how hard it was. I know that there's an awful lot of nisoyon you went through, but don't worry. You look over there, look in your account, press the computer and see how much has been stored up for you over the years. It's all waiting for you. He wants to have that relationship with us where He's our creditor rather than our debtor. And it's all in our hands. The Ribbono Shel Olam has given us such a powerful job to do that involves so little effort that if we'll only do it with ne'emanus, with straightness and with trust, we're able to establish that relationship of Ikev Tishmun as a result of our doing, that the Ribbono Shel Olam has that in store for us. So when the Chovas Halvava says that Avodas Hashem is based on that Hakoras HaToiv, that we've got to feel that debt of gratitude, it's not just the gratitude for the nice weather and the gratitude for the lovely children and the gratitude for the good health. That's not the gratitude. It's gratitude to the Ribbono Shel Olam for giving us the opportunity to become His creditors. That's the purpose of life. That gives us chayus. That's what makes us alive. To make us a be'er rather than a boyer. That we can be creditors rather than debtors. And that He does that not by putting us into a miserable life where we are in suffering and pain. And that's not the way He does it. He does it by putting us into a very beautiful world where we enjoy lots of pleasure and nachas. But overriding all that pleasure, with a job of work he's given us to do that is so much more important and so much more valuable. But when we do the job karoi, when we do the job as we have to do, the benefits we've got, the pleasures we've got, that's nothing compared to the schar, to the reward, to the recognition which the Ribbono Shel Olam holds in trust for us, le'osid lovli.